Do this morning is Pesach. I mean, we're here, and also to give you something to say at the Seder, and also to explain Pesach this year, and also because I brought, you'll hear in a moment, something that you can find on the internet, which is where I found them, because I knew what I was looking for, and I just typed in a couple of keywords, but you can do the same if you want to use them at your Pesach Seder. But first, let me start, because we don't actually have a chance to explain to everyone, although I will on Shabbat. Let me explain how you're supposed to do Pesach this year with Saturday night. The question is, when did you stop eating chametz? And what do you do with the chametz? Because normally, let's say the Seder was tonight, you would have stopped eating chametz this morning, burned it, and been done with it. But the problem from the point of view of Jewish law is that you're supposed to have bread at Shabbat meals. You're supposed to make motzi. So how can you do that if you're not permitted to have bread? And there really are two broad ideas. One is that you eat bread on Friday and Shabbat in a small circumscribed area of your house. That is, you burn it Saturday morning, you collect it Saturday morning, but you either burn some of it or don't burn it. And then Saturday night after Shabbat is over, you burn the rest and begin the Seder. So you have a small area of your house that's the designated chametz area, or else the other way of doing it is that you have something like matzah ashira, which is egg matzah, over which you can make the motzi, but is kosher for Pesach. But it's not really, you're not really supposed to use it for Pesach, because it's not real matzah, because it has egg in it. Okay, that's why matzah ashira means enriched matzah. And you use that on Shabbat, and you just make the motzi over matzah ashira. Those are the two different ways, okay? So this morning, I read something really interesting right before I came here from Shlomo Riskin. Who is a rabbi, used to be the rabbi of Lincoln Square in New York, and now is the rabbi of, I think it's Efrat in Israel. And he talked about Maimonides' ruling. This is how it goes. This is Maimonides' ruling commented on by Rabbi Soloveitchik that Rabbi Riskin mentions, that I'll tell you. This is how rabbinic chains work. So Riskin said Maimonides talks about not destroying bread on Shabbat, because one opinion of the sages is that you should actually destroy the bread on Shabbat, but you can't burn it, so you throw it into the sea, and you get rid of the bread that way. He said our equivalent would be flushing it down the toilet, right, if you're not near the sea, but the point is you get rid of it. But Maimonides says you shouldn't do that, even though the sages say you should. Now, Maimonides came 1,000 years after the sages, so the question is, why does he disagree with them? He doesn't give a reason. I'll take the question in just a second. So Soloveitchik gives the following answer. This is Soloveitchik's answer, which I think is actually beautiful and interesting. He says, do you remember what bread represents on Pesach? Right? What is matzah represents humility, because it's flat, and bread represents the yetzer hara, the evil inclination. It's puffed up, it's full of pride, that kind of thing, right? So Maimonides says that the general, the first stage, let's put it that way, the first stage of trying to overcome the evil inclination is to destroy it. That's what people start off thinking, according to Soloveitchik. This is Soloveitchik on Maimonides. But he says, once Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur were introduced into the world, then the idea of repentance took over from the idea of destruction. And people understood what you do with the Yetzer Hara is not to destroy it, but to elevate it, to change it. And so Shabbat, which represents creation, just like Rosh Hashanah, instead of just liberation, which is Pesach, on Shabbat you're not allowed to destroy, even to destroy something bad. Instead, you seek to change it. And that's why on Shabbat you don't destroy bread. You wait till after the Shabbat if you're going to destroy it. So that was, I thought, a nice slightly complicated, but a nice thing that I, there were a couple of questions, yeah. Biur Chametz is an old tradition. I would be surprised, actually, although I don't know for a fact, but it's in all the law codes that you burn it as a symbolic way of destroying all the chametz in your house. First you gather it all, and then you burn it.
So
you wrap it up. You wrap it up in a towel, and you burn it. Right. You literally burn it.
So donating the chametz.
You do that too. No, the two things are different. You do both. Mm-hmm. You sell all the chametz in your house. Right, or sell all the chametz in your possession. Right, we have, in fact, in the chapel, we have a list that people have been signing up for the past 2 weeks and paying a certain amount and selling all their chametz. But whatever, but the night before, the morning before the Seder, you do a bidikat chametz. You go around the house and you find all the chametz that is left. The tradition is to plant a couple pieces of chametz, and the kids find it, right? And then you gather it all together, and the next morning, you burn it. That is, there shouldn't be any chametz in all your establishment, so you burn whatever chametz you still have, usually symbolic pieces of bread. But you do both to get rid of the chametz. And I don't know for a fact, I mean, I have to check, but all, as far as I know, the Biur Chametz is also in the Sephardic law codes because it's in the Shulchan Aruch. But I don't, may not be in the Persian tradition. I don't know. What? No? It's, if it's in your possession, it's in your possession. It doesn't matter where it is. So you still have to sell it, but you can have it. Remember, you can have it locked away, but it doesn't belong to you for the period of Pesach, and you're not supposed to have it open. But people have, I mean, people who have businesses, for example, they symbolically sell their business, things like that. So, and you were going to say something. Oh, okay, yeah.
What do you do about dog food?
Me, or? I would guess that if you went to Pico, right, they probably have kosher Pesach dog food. I wouldn't worry about it. You know, so it's not, it's actually, the truth is that you're, it's stricter on Pesach than it is for kashrut in general, because it's not just that you're not supposed to eat chametz, you're not supposed to benefit from it, right? Which is why you close your business. But I mean, I think if you have no choice, then that's what you, I would, you know, yeah.
And what about starting the Seder? Considering that Shabbat ends late and...
Right. So again, it depends. Strictly according to Jewish law, you can't start it early. So what else can I tell you? According to Jewish law, you can't start it early. If you ask me would I start it early, yeah, I would start it early.
And
yeah.
Then you just do...
Right.
The candlelight.
Yeah. Well, let me actually... That's someone actually wrote me yesterday, how do you do the Havdalah? And the truth is you don't do Havdalah. You do Havdalah in the evening service on Saturday night, but you don't light a Havdalah candle and so on and so forth. What you do is you light the candles for Pesach, but you're supposed to light it from an existing flame on Yom Tov, right? You're not supposed to light a new flame, although people often do. You're supposed to light from an existing flame. This is why in Orthodox circles, they used to kid about the fact that people would light one cigarette with another, right? Because you're supposed to light from an existing flame. But the Havdalah is done during the service, not the regular Havdalah, because it's Bein Kodesh L'Kodesh, right? Because it's one holiday to another. There isn't Bein Kodesh L'Chol. There's not between the Shabbat and the week. So you do the Havdalah in the Ma'arif service, and then when the time comes an hour after Shabbat, you light the candles for Pesach.
When the kids are not with us, they are
right.
Far away. What a tip I can give them that they can do?
In terms of what?
Because he's in school and he's far from us.
Right.
It's very hard to...
To make a Seder?
Make a Seder.
Where are they? Okay, my guess.
There's a quarter over there, I know, but they closed. I go over there last week and I go around and I find a synagogue, but they're closed. They're closed for a week.
Yeah, the only thing I can advise you is for them to ask a rabbi there or someone there, because I just don't know what's available. But I have no, look, Paris has the, what, France has the third largest Jewish community in the world. So I'm sure there are all sorts of things available. I just don't know what they are. What's that?
All of them going to be closed. That's what the problem.
I don't know the answer to that. I do have the name of an address of a conservative rabbi or two in Paris that they can check with. So if you call my office, we have the Rabbinical Assembly, which is the conservative, has a guide to all the conservative rabbis in the world, and some of them are in France, some of them are in, you know, Britain, so on.
Rabbi, were you saying that the Haftarah is part of the Maariv service or the
Yes.
Seder service?
Maariv no, the Maariv service.
If one is not participating in the Maariv service and nobody in one Seder has been part of the Maariv service, do you incorporate Haftarah into the Seder or do you not do it?
No, you don't do it.
Really? They have it in the Haggadah.
They have it in the Haggadah as part of the Maariv service, but that's also, yeah, that's what it should be. What do you have there?
This is the Noam Sion.
Right.
And
what does he have?
And he has a part of, at the end of the Kiddush.
Can I see? On Saturday night. Right, but he doesn't have a... he doesn't have the candle and the spices. He doesn't have the Havdalah service. He just has the Havdalah blessing. Right. Yeah. Well, oh, I see. You mean, can you make the Havdalah blessing alone during it? I guess so. Although, the truth is you've already done it during the Maariv service.
Unless you haven't.
Unless you haven't. Yeah, unless you haven't. Right. I don't know why. So I guess, yes. So I guess after the first cup. Before the Shehecheyanu, you make the Haftalah blessing. Huh. So I take it back. Yeah, you have Haftalah after the first cup, and he has it before Shehecheyanu, but no spices, no candle. Well, because the reason you don't have spices or, thank you, the reason you don't have spices or a candle is because the spices are for the extra soul that you have on Shabbat, remember? And you're going into Pesach, so that doesn't apply. You still have because of the holiday. And you're not allowed to actually light a candle except from an existing flame. The reason that you can light in the first place is because you've made Haftalah during the Maariv service, right? In other words, on a regular Saturday night, you actually aren't allowed to light the Haftalah candle because it's still Shabbat. The reason that you can is because on the Saturday night Maariv service in the Amidah, there's a Havdalah blessing. So by the time you actually make Havdalah, the truth is Shabbat is already over. That's how come you can do it. So,
Is there any symbolic reason for the 10 plagues, like frogs? What do they really mean? I don't know if there is any other meaning. I know there is something about darkness and
right.
That, but
I mean, all of them have been given symbolic meanings. Usually the meaning, the one with the frogs and also is the same as with the blood, which is that God controls the Nile, which was a god to the Egyptians. You know, in the Haggadah, there's a midrashic meaning since it says, since at one point the it's used in the singular instead of the plural, that I think it's Rabbi Akiva says that it was one very large frog. But apart from that, the idea is that all the facets of nature, animals, weather, disease, rivers, all of them are under God's control. So, but there's also, well, there are also interesting ways of dividing up the plagues. I don't remember. Tzioni Zevit had a really good article about the ways that the plagues divide up into different natural categories, but now I can't remember what it was. I have to go back and take a look at it. So, yeah.
So when is the last time that you could have chametz? Saturday morning, like at 10 or?
Actually, after services for Saturday for the second meal. Usually Suda Shlishit, in theory, even Suda Shlishit you could, although I think that most people would tell you not to. I mean, I'll tell you what he says here, because I got this off, I looked at several different...
Usually the morning before, so the morning, but since it's Shabbat, one, you're supposed to have it.
One option is to eat challah at the beginning of the meal, then rinse one's mouth, wash one's hand, change the tablecloth, and continue eating there using Passover vessels without any challah. If the meal's continued in a different room, one should return to, say, Birkat HaMazon, where one ate the bread. And that's for the third meal. That's for Suda Shlishit. But as I said, that's the most lenient. So,
which means like Saturday afternoon, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Here, I'll tell you 1 second. Here we go. In order to fulfill the obligation of eating the third meal on Shabbat, oh, he has a different. Shita, this is a good one. One should split the morning meal into two parts. Eat, say Birkat HaMazon, then make a brief interruption by learning Torah or taking a walk, then wash again and eat Suda Shlishit. Bread and matzah are forbidden in the afternoon. So in other words, you do a Suda Shlishit, but you do it in the morning. Oh. And then by the time the services are over, you can't have bread anymore. Okay?
Thanks for making it more complicated.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's why people use matzah ashira. That's why people use egg matzah. Egg matzah is the easiest solution. But remember, this is about the mitzvah of always having bread with a meal on Shabbat. So if you have a meal without bread, you know, you'll survive.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So the... I mean, they got, you know, this I got several different responses on this. One of them talks about the fact that once you eat the meal in the morning with bread, then you have to go outside and brush off your clothes. But you're not allowed to brush off your clothes with a brush. You have to do it with your hand. Because if you do it with a brush, then of course the chometz will cling to the brush, which you're going to then bring back into your house. So it gets very detailed.
What's that?
Yeah, well, that's the funny part of all of this, which is that in theory, you've sold all your chametz, so it doesn't matter. But the reason, what you've sold, the idea is you've gotten rid of all chametz you possibly can. And the only thing that you've sold is the chametz that you actually want to keep and use after Pesach, right? So that's what you've sold. But all the other chametz that you possibly could get rid of, you have gotten rid of.
Maybe we should write a book, like if you give a mouse a cookie.
Right, exactly. If you give a Jew a piece of bread. Okay, so. That is it's an excellent idea. All right, other questions? Or yeah.
It might be very primitive, but all through the year, we bless bread.
Right.
And for this week, we treat bread as something evil.
Bad. It's not primitive at all. It's actually, I mean, it is, I agree, it's a strange thing to think of bread as bad when all the rest of the year you think of it as good. And the only answer that I have is that everything depends on context, right? In the context of the Seder, we look at bread differently because of matzah. But the rest of the year, we look at it as a blessing. So, I mean, you could make a Soloveitchik's kind of drasha, that everything good, you know, everything bad can be turned to good. But the answer is, you know, that the rest of the year, nobody makes that drasha about bread being bad, only on Pesach.
Is it supposed to, it should be a symbol of something.
Right.
Right. What is it?
The rest of the year?
No,
life.
No, when we burn the bread,
yeah,
we are supposed to purify ourselves.
It's a cleansing, right. So all of Pesach is supposed to be a cleansing and a beginning of renewal. Yeah.
We were taught when we were kids that we fast so that we can understand how the other, how the poor
do. Right.
So I want to know which rabbi said that, or where does it come from?
Said what?
Where this philosophy also comes from, besides the story.
About fasting?
No, about not having bread. about having matzah for 8 days. I mean, as kids, we were told that so you can sympathize with the poor also as well, not just the story of Passover.
Right. So I'm not sure what rabbi said what.
No, no. Where does this philosophy come from? Was it
the philosophy of the philosophy of sympathizing with the poor?
Right. So was it just something?
No. It's common because the idea of, I mean, it's not even a rabbi. It's essentially, you derive it straight from the story. Because the reason that they couldn't have bread was because they were rushed out of Egypt. So they didn't have time to bake bread properly. So they ate what is lechem oni. It's called lechem oni, which means the bread of affliction or the bread of poverty. Oni also means poverty. So it's right there in the story, is the idea. The other thing that matzah represents is haste, because that's what, you know, I talked about it last year, that I always wondered, why was matzah the symbol of, among all the symbols that you could choose for Pesach, why matzah? I mean, we're used to it now, but if you read the story, it's not obvious when you read the story in Exodus that matzah is going to be the thing that you would choose as the symbol. But then I read Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson's. The very powerful influence in his life was his aunt. Her name was Mary Moody Emerson. She was a brilliant woman, but given the time, basically nobody would really know much of her were it not for the fact that he writes down the kinds of things she used to say to him. And he told her once that he was in a hurry, and she said, "Hurry is for slaves." And I thought about that, and that's what the matzah represents. The matzah represents the fact that you can't control your own time. And to not be able to control your own time is a feature of slavery, right? Freedom is to be able to control your time. So it makes sense that the matzah represents slavery, because the matzah represents the inability to control your time because they had to rush out of Egypt. I want to read you, I got three great poems from Amichai. And I was searching for one, and lo and behold, as I typed in to the magical Google the words to get the first poem, up came a third poem that's all about Pesach. So the first poem, which is a great one, and it just reminds us that for, you know, every Pesach is on big themes, obviously, but freedom and history and so on. But really what Pesach comes down to in all of our homes is whether this part of the family is going to get along with that part of the family, right? The guests, the seating. That's what Pesach is really about, right? That's what makes it such a fraught holiday. So there's this great poem from Amichai that actually I excerpted a part of in the book that I have coming out in September, because I always loved this book. I always loved this poem. It's called Tourists, and it's very short. He says, "Once I sat on the steps." Unfortunately, the Hebrew didn't come up, but I'll give you the English. "Once I sat on the steps by a gate at David's Tower, I placed my two heavy baskets at my side. A group of tourists was standing around their guide, and I became their target marker. 'You see that man with the baskets? Just to the right of his head, there's an arch from the Roman period, just to the right of his head. But he's moving, he's moving.' And I said to myself, 'Redemption will come only if the guide tells them, you see that arch from the Roman period? It's not important. But next to it, left and down a bit, there sits a man who's brought fruit and vegetables for his family.'" Isn't that a wonderful poem? And it's exactly the problem with Jerusalem, right? Everybody always lives in history instead of in people. But then there are two other poems that came up on the same for whatever reason, and I want to read them both. They're both very short. One is called from one of his Jerusalem poems. "Every night, God takes his glittering merchandise out of his showcase, holy chariots, tablets of law, fancy beads, crosses and bells, and puts them back into dark boxes inside and pulls down the shutters. Again, not one prophet has come to buy." And that's of Jerusalem at night. So, and here's the one that came up that was about Pesach, and I didn't even know it. It's called "An Arab Shepherd is Searching for His Goat on Mount Zion." "An Arab shepherd is searching for his goat on Mount Zion, and on the opposite mountain, I'm searching for my little boy. An Arab shepherd and a Jewish father, both in their temporary failure. Our voices meet above the Sultan's pool in the valley between us. Neither of us wants the child or the goat to get caught in the wheels of the terrible Chad Gadya machine. Afterward, we found them among the bushes, and our voices came back inside us, laughing and crying. Searching for a goat or a son has always been the beginning of a new religion in these mountains. Isn't that tremendous? I Googled, actually, Amichai tourist vegetables. Because I remembered that was the, you know, or Amichai guide vegetables, or Amichai Roman vegetables. And I got this, but I'm more than happy to, it's from the Israel Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Yehuda Amichai poems, that's all. It's go to www.mfa.gov.il.
One more time, please.
www.mfa, that's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, .gov.il. And just look up Amichai, and you'll get those three poems. So it's the Israel Review of Arts and Letters. Anyway, so so of course this is what, yeah, go ahead.
That is so moving, and there's something you said earlier that just kind of hit me very strongly, and that was the thing about the destruction, about Yom Kippur, now that there's Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that we go from destruction and vengeance to repentance and redemption. That was such a profound thing, and it was, you said it in the midst of explaining something, but can you?
This is, for example, one of a Hasidic theme, which is that you that rather than destroy evil impulses, you elevate them, right? So machshavot ra'ot, which are bad thoughts, you're supposed to elevate. Bad thoughts in Hasidic terms are 95% of the time sexual thoughts, okay? So when you see someone that's beautiful, you're supposed to think, if that person is beautiful, how much more beautiful is the God who created such beauty? In other words, rather than say, oh, no, I can't think of beauty, you elevate it, right? And this goes back to the Talmudic theme of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, that when the rabbis, one day they found the evil inclination, they tied up the evil inclination, and they discovered that no children were born and no eggs were hatched in the kingdom. In other words, evil inclination is part of the creative impulse. The question is not destroying it, the question is directing it. So so that's what tshuva is supposed to do. Tshuva is supposed to not destroy what's inside of you, but purify it, or redirect it, or elevate it. I mean, the way the Hasidim put it is to elevate it. So, and on Pesach, I'll say one other thing about Pesach is that Pesach, you always have the expectation that Elijah is going to come, and there are a couple of other times that you expect Elijah. Right at a Brit Milah, you expect Elijah. And at the end of Shabbat, you sing for Elijah. And I'll give you two reasons for all of these. The second one is the nice one. The first one is more complicated. The reason you expect Elijah to bris at a Brit Milah, you have a Kisei Eliyahu, is because Elijah in the Torah gets very upset at the Israelites and says to God, they violated your covenant. Hefer et britecha. And so according to the rabbis, God got upset at Elijah for accusing the Israelites of violating the covenant. So he said, not only do they not violate the covenant, but every time they enact the covenant, you must be there. So that's why you have a Kisei Eliyahu then. The reason you have a kos for Eliyahu at the Seder is that, you know, the redemption from Egypt is supposed to presage the ultimate redemption, the redemption at the end of time. So Pesach is a good time for redemption to come. As it came in times before, it will come in future times. And the reason that you have it at the end of Shabbat is that it's actually mathematical, strange as this sounds, because the Messiah can't come on Shabbos, right? Which means that if he was programmed to come on Shabbat or on Friday, because on Friday he also can't come because you're preparing for Shabbat, according to the rabbi. So if he was scheduled for Friday or Saturday, he's going to come Saturday night. So you expect that he would come Saturday night. But the other thing is that all three of them are family times, right? All three of them are times when families gather together. And what Malachi says, as we read on Pesach about Elijah, is what's going to happen when Elijah comes is Veheshiv levavot al banim velev banim al avotam, which means that the hearts of parents will be turned to children and the hearts of children to parents. So there is this sort of messianic flavor of families at the time of the... What's that?
What does it mean?
Veheshiv means to turn, lev, the hearts, avot, of parents or fathers, to children, right? In other words, they'll love each other more. That's what it means to turn your heart to someone, right? That they will, instead of fighting, they'll be joined together. So that's because remember also that before the Messiah comes, according to many traditions, there's going to be a bad time. So when the Messiah comes, there's supposed to be a time of love. All right, any other questions on Pesach? Yeah.
Going back, that it's about bad thoughts and how you're supposed to reprogram yourself. I keep getting emails, especially from the Kabbalah Center and all that, that if I don't like somebody, that person is truly has some issues. It's until I change my idea and my reflection about that person is not going to change. So not only I have to go through with that person's behavior, it's even my fault now.
Right.
So it's a catch-22. What did I do here?
Well, there are two. I would say yes and no. That is, how you treat people does change the way they act towards you to some extent. But you can't take away someone else's agency, their ability to act, right? You can treat someone very nicely and they can still be miserable. And to assume that it's you, and in some ways that's very egotistical for them to say that, because to assume that it's all about me means that they have no free will at all. Mm-hmm. It's all about how I act, and I don't believe that. I just don't believe it. I mean, why did Pharaoh do that? Is it because Moses wasn't loving enough?
Yeah. What is the correct translation of mana mean in English?
Of what?
The mana, the food from mana.
There is no, right, no mana is how they translate it, right. Manna from heaven.
It's not the opposite of matzah, right?
No.
I think it's chocolate.
What? She said chocolate. I think that's true. I think that's actually correct. I've never seen it translated actually other than manna. I don't know what the root is, but that's an interesting question, what the root is of manna. I don't know.
Thanks. Sure. It's a portion, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't know if that's the same root. I don't know. It might be. It might just mean portion. Yeah.
I have a 20th century question. It's always trouble.
Yeah.
What was the rush? How could you rush any faster than you normally lived in those days? You can only stride as quickly as you can. It takes about 18 minutes to make the unleavened bread. It seems to me the rush has to have some other meaning other than physical movement, because 600,000 people couldn't get very far with an army behind.
I don't understand what the
idea is. We right. always say that we have matzah
because they had to be out by the next morning, because they didn't want to linger for Pharaoh to change his mind.
It was 18 minutes, perhaps.
Even so you threw it in and you took it out and you ran. I mean, that's at least that's how the Bible is intended to portray it. So
I mean, that's the surface story, but I just can't see a herd of people.
Shame. Rushing?
I mean it rather seriously, because it is a serious matter. They've been told to get up.
Right,
move,
exactly.
Because. And I would think there's more anxiety and fear than there is hurry.
I think those three things will probably all go together. Anxiety, fear, and hurry, and this is their chance to get out. So they run.
So that Matzo can...
So they run. Of course, they do have time to go around to the Egyptians' houses and take their riches. Right. But that was probably riches. But that was probably done during the plague of darkness. Yeah.
I don't know if you already talked about this about matzah, but it seems to me it sort of contradicts the holiday, because it's supposed to be a holiday of joy and celebration. Yet eating matzah for 8 days for a lot of us is not so joyful and is a limitation. meditation, and it's almost like we get released after the holiday rather than during the holiday.
Well, so I would say every observance actually has both of those elements. Every observance, every discipline, every observance has constraint and liberation. So the same thing is true of matzah, right? I mean, what joy doesn't have that? You have to go to synagogue on Simchas Torah and dance around, right? Some people like dancing around with the Torah, some people don't. But I think that that is true, and that's like that is the old joke. We can end with the old joke, which I'm sure you all know, but I'll tell you anyway, because it's a great joke about the man who marries, the man rather, who lives in Eastern Europe, and he and his wife hear that there's going to be a terrible persecution against the Jews. So he comes home and he says to her, listen, dear, it's going to be this terrible persecution against the Jews. I know you don't want to do this, but I think we have to convert to Christianity. And she goes, I can't convert to Christianity. He says, well, you know, it's that really, or we may die. And she says, okay, we'll convert to Christianity. So they convert to Christianity, and the old czar dies, and the new czar comes along, and he rescinds all the laws, and he comes home, and he says, wonderful news. He says, we don't have to be Christians anymore. We can go back to being Jewish. She says, that's great. I'm so happy. Can we wait till after Pesach? So, all right. Have a Chag Kasher V'Sameach.